Turn this evening to Prophet Haggai, for a little while at least. Prophet Haggai in chapter 2. We are taking it up at chapter 2. Maybe I can just rehearse very quickly what is contained in this little prophecy before this. Chapter 1 in particular tells us how the people, the Jews, were stirred to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. And the dates that are provided make it very clear that it was around 18 years after the first Jews had returned from their exile in Babylon. And you might remember the prophecy of that exile was that it would be for 70 years. The exile began with Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians, destroying both Jerusalem and Solomon's temple, glorious temple, that was destroyed in the middle of the city. It was that destruction particularly, as well as the city wall, that devastated the people, not simply that they were exiled, taken from the land, it was that devastated them too, but the destruction that was wrought in the city was a devastating occasion. There were some around at the time, such as Jeremiah, who were very clear on the significance of that, while there were many others who simply sensed, perhaps they couldn't put more flesh on it than to say, something has gone seriously wrong with us. We are God's people. This is God's house, and it's destroyed. His favorite city is destroyed. They could tell at least that God could not be favoring them any longer. That imposing symbol of his presence being reduced to a heap of rubble. So after 70 years of exile, some were commissioned to return to the land. And very soon after, within the first 2 years, a small start had been made on the rebuilding of the temple, but they stopped. They seem to have laid the foundation, or at least part of the foundation, and then they stopped. Back in chapter 1 and verse 2, God quotes them. They give their reasons for not going on with building the temple. In verse 2, God reminds them, "This people says, the time has not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built." Now, what foundation do they have for saying that? Why was it not the time? It was because they had to, as he says in verse 4 and following, they had to find homes. They had to kit out their homes to dwell in. Dwell in paneled houses. Now, if you pause for a moment and you think of the native forms of construction. A basic house can be made without panels. A paneled house is something where people have invested and invested. They have gone up to the hills and they have cut down the wood and they have trimmed the wood and they've tidied it and they've made their houses look wonderful so that they could live in them. That had to come first, it seems. They had to sow their fields. And in verse 6, they had to get their food and their drink. They had to get their clothes. They had to earn wages. But, as verse 6 says, they'd found all that terribly ineffective labor. And that's called to mind again in chapter 2 in the verses that we read, verse 16 through to 17. The time is not yet to build that the Lord's house should be built. Why? So that they could have their houses paneled, sow their fields, food and drink, earn wages. But simultaneously, Haggai and Zechariah came to call the people to return to the key project, God's house. The message was, you've been focused on all of these things for yourself, you've neglected God's house, But if you had dealt with God's house first, those very things that you've been looking for yourself would have been resolved. There is a call that they return to this key project. It's mentioned also in the account of Ezra, before Ezra came back to Jerusalem as well. They received this call first from Haggai, very briefly, these two chapters. Zechariah extends much the same kind of call, and he backs it up and he advances the ministry, encouraging them further. They received the call and then they did it. Chapter 1 tells us that they obeyed. They got engaged in the work and they did a very quick work to erect a new temple at the end of chapter 1. Chapter 2 verse 3 tells us that it was not a very impressive building. If there was anyone who remembered Solomon's temple, they would be very, perhaps even discouraged as they looked at it. It was not an impressive structure. But it was a structure, it was God's house, and it was an indication that God was among them. And so it is now, once the temple is up, that the Lord takes them back to think again on what has taken place. From chapter 2, verse 10, through to the end of the chapter. Can I also remind you that Haggai, though I've given you some time scales, 18 years after return to Jerusalem, and Zechariah was with him. It was a little while later that Ezra came to teach the law, and then Nehemiah came and he rebuilt the wall of the city, and then it was finally roughly 40 years later that Malachi also came. But you find in each of these, the reason I mention them, you have Haggai, you have Zechariah, you have Ezra, you have Nehemiah, you have Malachi, and in every one of those, following the exile, you have much the same question. Where are you giving your attention? Are you giving your attention to your houses and your fields, or are you giving your attention to God's house and God's presence among you? The same question in Ezra, same question in Nehemiah, in Malachi as well, addressed over a further 70 years after the return. And in the middle of all those, between Haggai, Zechariah, and Ezra and Nehemiah particularly, you have Esther in another part of the country, of the world, but she's in there too. And this same question is there, looming in the background, like one of those storm clouds that never pours rain. The question is not asked there, but it's there in the background. The same people, the Jews, although in a different place, asking this point. Yes, you nominally belong to the Lord, this God of the covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But have you turned to him? How true are your hearts to him? And it's still the same question that he asks ever since. We have this matter raised before the people in two parts. And this evening I would like to look at verses 10 to 19 that we have read. And all being well, we might go on to take it up from verse 20 to 23 the next time. The first part, 10 to 19, you might call the analysis. And then there's the elaboration of the blessing, God's purpose of blessing, from verse 20 onwards. So first we're looking at something of essentially an analysis and a pointer forward, verses 10 to 19. And we have a few questions that there's a questioning manner in which God is speaking to Israel, so we are faced with questions. And you might sum up the first question as, where does holiness come from? We're also faced with the question, why is holiness important? And then at the very close of this passage, verse 19, also the question, where will we find hope? That was so important for Israel and has been for every generation of man. Still is today. Where is our hope? Where does holiness come from, first of all, then? Ask the priests. They should know. That was one of their primary duties. We're told that in Leviticus chapter 10. One of the things that they were, as well as the sacrifices, they were to be able to distinguish in the law and to be able to teach the people God's law. Ezra took that seriously sometime after this, and he had devoted his life to understanding in order to be able to teach the law. So ask the priests this question. It concerns the law, verse 11. And God presents them with two examples. In verse 12, you have holy meat. It's carried in a fold of a garment. That's permissible. It's holy. But if that garment, even the garment that holds that meat, that holy meat, if it touches any kind of other food, does it convey its holiness to that food? Does it transmit holiness to the other food? That's the question. Does it become holy? And what's the priest's answer? Let me ask you, what's the priest? What do the priests say? No. No uncertainty, no fuzziness about the answer. So that's one example. There's holy meat. It touches other food. Does it spread the holiness? No, it doesn't. The next example, verse 13, somebody is unclean because of a dead body. We read that just not so long ago in Numbers about the Passover. There were some who recognized their personal uncleanness, and they asked, what do we do? So this is the second example. Here you yourself are unclean, and if you touch any of those things in verse 12, bread, stew, wine, oil, any food, you're unclean, you touch these things, will it make those things unclean? What's the answer? Yes, it shall be unclean. You might put it this way, uncleanness is contagious in the world of man, but holiness isn't. It doesn't pass back the other way. The holiness that we're talking about here, the holy meat, is meat that is consecrated by the rituals that God had ordained. But this shows just how easily that can be dissolved, you might say, with all the unholiness, uncleanness that's around. But it doesn't work the other way, that when we are unclean ourselves, we do make other things unclean. It is contagious. And this is what God is saying to his people in verse 14. So is this people. It's about you. It's not just about the meat and the rituals and the symbols and so on, that the things that you handle. It's about you. It's about yourselves. It's your own hearts and your lives. This people, this nation, every work of their hands, the things that they offer, unclean. And so where does that uncleanness come from? It comes from them. They are spreading their uncleanness into the offerings that they make and the works of their hands. Everything they touched was defiled, even the holy things, or the otherwise holy things. They were being called then to consider their hearts. They were proceeding, they were going ahead with the outward acts of worship, making offerings. Did they suppose that they were enough? And now that they had a temple again, this is why God is asking the question, how are you going to use that? How are you going to treat it? How do you regard it? Do you understand what it's all about? Now that they had a temple, would they go ahead and just presume that God would receive them and bless them? It was for the people, it's for us. You know that God is holy? What do you rely on for your holiness? Holiness to be acceptable before God. How can holy meat be kept holy? How can unclean things be cleansed? The Lord is saying, you don't have it yet. You need to be seeking it. You need to be truly devoted servants. There needs to be a change within your hearts that you yourselves are holy. So very briefly then, the holiness, it is not a thing that we have and can convey ourselves. We must turn to the Lord, and that is why where we are taken further, where the people were taken as they were called to consider. But it also deals with why holiness is important. It comes down to this question of blessing that they've been looking for. Did they desire that God should bless them? Then they were being asked to carefully consider, is God first in your heart and your life? It was not just meat that had to be made holy, not just meat that had to be set apart for his use, his worship, but also to be his people. They had already had many warning signs and indications in verses 16 and 17. In all those days, you weren't getting what you were hoping for. Whether it be the wheat or the wine, any of those things, they were just vanishing before your very eyes. But it didn't make any difference. You didn't stop and you didn't consider. This is a word that Haggai uses a lot, is considered. Stop and think about it. You still didn't turn to me. I have mentioned how it seems that they were making their offerings. The priests were very active. They've been called on in those earlier verses. The indications are that the rituals, the ceremonial law was being observed all this time. But still, it didn't mean that they had turned to the Lord. There was the outward aspects of worship, but there was something missing. And it was that devotion to the Lord, turning to him, that they were set apart to him. They were made holy in his presence. That's the way of blessing. That's the contrast. Turn to me if you would have those things filled and those blessings that you're seeking after. It's the way of blessing first because it is the way by which we might stand before God and stand with him. If we don't do that, why should he provide for a disobedient people, a regardless people, an assuming people, a presuming people? Why should he not prevent another enemy from coming to overwhelm his people? Because this is the same, would be the character of their lives before ever the exile and before the destruction. For so many years beforehand, the Jews in Judea had been going through their forms of religion. But why were they banished? Why were they exiled? Because their hearts were not in it. And God is saying to them, your hearts are still not in it. For a little time under Ezra, for a little time with Nehemiah, for a little time in between, following Nehemiah, their hearts were perhaps in it. But Malachi had to come again and call them back again. They were going through the rituals as far as they possibly could. They were going through the whole thing. But they were a long way from the Lord. Their hearts were not in it. You're doing all these things, yet you did not turn to me. It was not to me. So they were surviving. But it could have been so much more. They'd been liable to so many griefs unnecessarily. And it was paralleled by their fellow Jews back in the east in Babylon, in Susa, that we read about in Esther, just very shortly after this. But God is saying, if you will turn to me, if you will be holy to me, I can give you hope. We will not find holiness in ourselves. We must go to Him for that holiness, but we must have that holiness if He is to be able to bless us. We must belong to Him, devoted to Him, our hearts given to Him. And then He also makes a promise of hope. There is that challenge in front of the people then, as there is for everyone still today. There is for us too, to look at our hearts, to carefully consider as well. But it's not the end of the story. There is hope of blessing. At the very end of verse 19, you don't have, you need to do some thinking. Think from this point, this is a marker in your lives. The vine, the fig tree, the pomegranate, the olive tree, they haven't yielded fruit. But from this day, this marker in your lives, from this day, I will bless you. He goes on to detail something of that blessing in the remaining verses of the chapter. This is blessing that they have been hoping for. They've been wishing for, at least. They've been looking for in some way. Blessing from the Lord. What has happened to this call for holiness? Has the Lord just said, well, you haven't done it, but I'm going to bless you anyway? You haven't turned to me. You don't have that holiness of heart and life. But I will bless you anyway. Is that what he's saying? I don't think so. That call will never be dispensed with. It is the only way. It is the only way that we might walk with the Lord. But the Lord still assures of blessing. That gives the implication. It ties the thing together. And in between, it's indicating that God is going to be also working, not just in providing the wheat and the grapes on the vine and all of these fruits that they've been looking for. He's not just going to do that. But He will bless by changing men's hearts. He will bless that by that inward change through which their offerings can and will become holy. This was promised by Jeremiah, by Ezekiel, that God said, I will take out that old heart and I will put in a new heart, a new spirit, and I will set my law. It's the new covenant. I'll set my law in their hearts. Those things that were such a struggle and led men to turn away from God. And what happens in the remaining verses is that the focus is on one man. And that's a pointer further forward as well. He signifies the great one that would be the blessing from his own family, the family of David, the house of David. But what the Lord is indicating here in these few words is saying to them, I have not given you what you were wishing for. I have not given you what you were in fact expecting. But nor have you been giving me what belongs to me, honor and glory and service and love. And it's that would have brought you reward. You haven't received what you expected. You haven't given me what is mine. But he's saying, I will be the one who will bless you. Don't risk going elsewhere. That's exactly what they've been doing all the way up to the exile. How often God said, you've been going after Assyria or Egypt. Where am I? He says, I will bless you. You're in a bad way at the moment, but You will not find any better anywhere else. I will be the one who blesses you. You are my chosen people. I will bless you. Stay with me. But be different. Be holy. What does this mean for us? Devoted hearts. The whole scene there is that people said, God can wait. I'm going to work out what's important for my life, and then I'll look after his interests. A devoted heart rather says, let God choose the blessings. If I go after my preferences, they're going to lead me astray, and they will lead me away from him. As Paul said, exercise yourself toward godliness. You can follow all sorts of other exercises in life, but there's nothing to compare with godliness. It's profitable for all things. And realize that this question of holiness, the question leveled to the priests here, this question of holiness has been transformed. Then you take a holy thing, you brush it up against an unclean thing, and the holy thing becomes unclean. If we are set apart to God and we're involved in something unclean, it will make us unclean. But that's been transformed. There is one who is holy by nature, not just by a ritual exercise. He is inherently holy. One of the things that disturbed so many people around him at the time was that he was a friend of sinners. And they regarded this as an unclean thing. But all that he touches is made holy. He cannot be made unclean. That's signified in that image, vision that Peter saw, where God, if God calls something clean, don't you call it unclean. But it's only the Lord who can make this difference. It's the Lord Jesus himself who has come amongst us to make us holy. But therefore, it's for us to ask for his close presence in your life, to live in you, that the Lord will never turn you away. And there's that blessing that will follow, which is far more than you could imagine or that you would ask for. And there's further on that in the remaining part of the chapter. But the question that was directed to the people of the day is, you follow all of these things, you regard yourself as God's particular people, just as the Jews in Susa did in Esther's day. But where is your heart? Is your heart pursuing the Lord? Do you not bring great trouble on yourself because you have not sought him first? Seek the Lord, his kingdom, his righteousness, and all these other things will be added to you, our Lord Jesus said. And just so far this evening, may God grant blessing. May his word speak to us also.